Good afternoon. I'm going to begin our program. My name is Justin Adams. I'm an associate at Traeger & Took and chairman of the local Federalist Society Lawyers Chapter. I'm pleased to welcome you to today's panel discussion on Tennessee's system for appointing its attorney general and reporter. Before I introduce our speakers, I'd like to thank Waller Lansden for hosting this event and handling all the myriad logistical details that go into this sort of event. Waller has many times in the past been a very gracious host, and we're always appreciative of that. As to our speakers, we have here a panel of three people eminently qualified to discuss Tennessee's system of attorney general selection. We have Senator Mae Beavers, former Attorney General and reporter Paul Summers, and Ammon Smart. Senator Beavers is a member of the Tennessee Senate for the 17th District. She's chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee and sponsor of Senate Joint Resolution Number 23, which would amend the Tennessee Constitution to provide for the direct popular election of the Attorney General and reporter. General Summers, is a partner here at Waller Lansden and served as Attorney General and reporter from 1999 until 2006. And Mr. Smart is an associate here at Waller Lansden and the author of a paper entitled A Report on Tennessee Attorney General Selection, which has been published by the Federalist Society and which copies of which are available today if you haven't picked one up yet already. I'm going to serve as moderator. Mr. Smart will open the discussion with a 5-minute overview of Tennessee's system and how it fits in with the systems used by the other 49 states to select their attorneys general. Then our panelists will take turns discussing the pros and cons of the present system of judicial appointment versus popular election or even gubernatorial appointment, after which we'll open up the floor for questions. So after Ammon makes his presentation, then Senator Beavers will speak for about 10 minutes on popular election, General Summers on the present system, and then Ammon will respond to that, and Senator Beavers and General Summers will then in turn respond about 5 minutes apiece. Then we'll open the floor to questions. With that, I think we're ready to begin. Let's welcome our speakers with a round of applause and then get started.
Thank you, Justin. Thank you, everyone, for coming. Before I get started, I actually am a co-author of a report on Tennessee Attorney General selection. Keith Randall is here, and I wanted to recognize him. Keith, if you could stand up. And I'm glad you're here, Keith, because to the extent that there are any detailed questions about the research, you can address those. But I want to give just a brief introduction on where we are in Tennessee today with respect to Attorney General selection and how the process has worked. I'm starting on the assumption that most people in the room already have a pretty good feel for how things work in Tennessee with respect to the judiciary, particularly the Tennessee plan. The Tennessee plan and the appointment of the Attorney General are inseparable. The two go hand in hand. But I'm not going to spend too much time in discussing the Tennessee plan and how that works, so I'm going to proceed on the assumption that everyone understands that process. Having said that, Over the past couple of years, actually the past several years, there's been a lot of debate about the judiciary in Tennessee with respect to whether or not the Tennessee plan is constitutional or with respect to whether or not the Tennessee plan is the best policy choice for Tennessee. Only more recently have we started to debate whether or not the current structure as provided in the Constitution for appointment of the Attorney General by the state Supreme Court is also the best policy decision for the state of Tennessee. And oftentimes when we hear these issues debated, particularly a lot of the rhetoric on both sides, but in particular for those who tend to support the current structure, would often say, well, we don't want to inject politics into the judiciary, in particular into the Supreme Court or into the Attorney General's office. And I always thought, you know, that's an interesting argument. So Keith and I got together and decided to research it to figure out, have politics already been injected to the process, or is in fact the current system the best way to have it structured to keep politics out of the process, whatever that may mean? And I think we'll get into that a little bit more as the panel progresses. And so, hence we have this paper. I want to start off first by looking at here, appendix 2 to the paper is an analysis, and it's on page 5. This is the first portion of it. But it goes through and does a side-by-side analysis of all of the Attorney General selection methods, or appointment methods, or election methods, however you want to summarize it, in the United States. As you can see, there are 6 states whose attorneys generals are appointed by the governor. Of those 6 states, most are appointed at the pleasure of the governor, meaning the governor can get rid of them when he wants. And you've got Hawaii there where, you know, the governor appoints with the advice and consent of the Senate. Lower down there, you see Tennessee. It's the only state out of the 50 states that appoints its attorney general by the Supreme Court. In Maine, sort of an odd duck as well, in that their attorney general is chosen by a joint legislature. The rest, as you can see, are elected, and it goes on to the next page. So I believe it's, 42 that are elected. But I also want to point out that their term of service. Obviously, the attorney generals that are appointed by the governor, most of them are appointed at the pleasure of the governor. But in Tennessee, that's appointed by the Supreme Court, serves for a term of 8 years. The closest other state that serves for that length of time is Virginia, for a term of 6 years. So a pretty interesting analysis in and of itself. Tennessee is an outlier. We're the only ones that do it this way. So the question is, why do we do it this way? And we'll get into that a little bit later. But so that's the state-by-state comparison as to how Tennessee compares to other states in the United States. The second thing that we looked at was, okay, there are three ways, essentially, based on the way other states do. You have federal model, is how I refer to it shorthand, or in other words, appointment by the governor, election, or what Tennessee does, excluding Maine. So we decided to slice and dice it in Tennessee based on politics, looking at it both from the standpoint of what might have happened if we had elected our attorney general as opposed to having our attorney general appointed by the Supreme Court, or what might have happened if we had a federal-type model in the state of Tennessee if the governor were to appoint the attorney general. And here are our findings. This table here shows the breakdown of all of the governors since 1971. Through current. We didn't include the most recent gubernatorial election, which, of course, everyone knows was Governor Haslam, a Republican who was elected. But in this column, you can see the attorney generals that served during that period of time. And, of course, you can see who's a Republican, who's a Democrat, and where there was a disconnect. Again, assuming that the governor would have appointed someone from his own party to serve as the attorney general. The second piece that we looked at was a comparative results in statewide offices by party affiliation since 1970. And what's interesting in Tennessee that there is only one official, state official, that is elected by statewide vote. That's the governor. Of course, you have the senators, so we included them in the analysis as well. And as you can see, since 1970, we've had 25 elections. The column here represents the GOP. The column here represents Democrats. 15 out of those 25 elections, GOP has won. Senate races, you know, breaking it down a little further, you can tell that out of 15 Senate races, 10 have been won by Republicans, while 5 have been 5 Democrats have won. Governors are evenly split, 50-50. Then you get over to the column of Attorney General. 9 of the attorney generals that have served have in one way or another been affiliated with the Democratic Party compared to a 0 from the Republican Party. And that research, as far as the determination of how, you know, how we considered who was a Republican or who was a Democrat, is found in Appendix 1. And here we list all of the attorneys general and the research that was done to determine their party affiliation. Pretty stark contrast. It's even, you know, this table breaks it down by party affiliation since 1990. Again, GOP has won 10 out of 15 races. Even more so, the Senate race is the larger contrast there. They've won 8 compared to the Democrats 2. And then Republicans only won 2 to 3 of the governor's races. And again, with respect to attorneys general, it's 4-0. So again, going back to the question, or at least the argument that we don't want to inject politics into these attorney general selection process. Well, I don't want to make any conclusions. I'll do that later. You can make your own conclusions from the findings of the paper as to whether or not politics have been injected into the process. But with that, I'll turn the time over to, I believe, Senator Beavers.
Thank you very much. I feel so unqualified to be up here. I'm the only one that is not an attorney. In fact, I'm the first non-attorney to chair the Judiciary Committee. I'm of the opinion that you have a conflict of interest if you're an attorney and chair the Judiciary Committee. Much the same way as the Attorney General, I believe, has a conflict practicing before the very people that appointed him. Senate Joint Resolution 23 provides an amendment to the Constitution for the popular election of the State Attorney General. Some argue that Tennessee's current method of choosing an attorney general is unique and that he operates in an independent manner. However, I believe that the method in which he is selected does not adhere to the framers of the Constitution's original intent, nor does it even comply with the attorney general's own website, which contends that the role of the attorney general is to provide the best legal service possible to the state and its citizens. As has been mentioned, Tennessee is the only state utilizing the Supreme Court to appoint the Attorney General. 43 of the 50 states select their Attorney Generals through popular election. The remaining 6 states use a governor appointment system with an appropriate check of power provided by the respective legislative bodies of that state. Also, such a power of appointing the Attorney General granted to the Supreme Court is extremely rare, and one that was only granted to him by the framers of the Constitution in the event that a Supreme Court would be held accountable to the citizens of this state via a free and fair election, much the same way that I am held accountable to the voters in this state through election. The role of the Attorney General of the State of Tennessee is to provide the best legal service possible to the state and its citizens. If that's true, then it doesn't make sense to me that he or she is currently twice removed from the citizens of Tennessee. Currently, the citizens of Tennessee must elect a governor who appoints Supreme Court justices, who in turn appoints the Attorney General. This process eliminates any possible practical or substantial check of the Attorney General by the people of Tennessee, the General's main and most important client. In addition, the Attorney General is responsible for cases at the appellate court level in the state of Tennessee. Such a role indicates an obvious conflict of interest problem between the Supreme Court and the Attorney General. In many cases, the Attorney General is required to present and argue cases before the same body, the state Supreme Court, which appointed that individual to office. The nature of the relationship between the Supreme Court and the attorney creates a negative public perception concerning the validity of any proceedings where both parties are involved. Although the practice of appeals courts may be fair and just, it still just doesn't take away from the fact that the public perception by the citizens of Tennessee is one where those biases remain. Therefore, in my opinion, the popular election of the Attorney General is the best remedy to ensure that the citizens of this state and the laws that this General Assembly enacts are best represented and defended. And you know, I know there have been many questions that we've had in the legislature over the years about opinions that we get from the district attorney, because we do want to make sure that they're unbiased. And I spoke to the framers of our Constitution. When the Constitution was first written, the Attorney General was elected and the Supreme Court judges were elected. That Constitution changed in 1870 when that changed to an appointment of the Attorney General. Then we get to the Tennessee Plan, where the Supreme Court is appointed by the governor. Things have changed down over the years, over the last decade. And we need to look at those changes, and we need to determine how best to, whether we want to elect an attorney general, or whether he should be appointed by the governor, or whether he should be, we should return him to the duties that he had at the very beginning, and that was just to keep the records for the Supreme Court, and give those other duties that were given to him by statute some years later after the Constitution was first written, give those duties to a Solicitor General. So those are the discussions that are gone on over in the legislature. I have the bill to elect Attorney General, and we'll be pursuing that.
General Summers?
Ready for me? Thank you very much, Justin and Ammon, and I'm privileged to be here with Senator May Beavers from the 17th Senatorial District, which consists, I believe, of 8 counties.
That's right.
In Middle Tennessee, from Mount Juliet. And I'm really proud to be here. I'm always enjoying when Waller helps sponsor groups such as yours, and particularly groups that my mother, Peggy Summers, who's in the back of the room, supports and gets your publications from. And she's a big Federalist Society person, and I appreciate the fact that she came here today along with my wife, Kim. In trying to think about some of the remarks that I wanted to make, I want it to be clear that I'm not here advocating, or at least I won't try to advocate for any particular position as to whether or not the attorney should be appointed or elected, appointed by some process, not necessarily by the Supreme Court, or elected in a partisan election. But why I'm here, and hopefully I won't make any Freudian slips and allow you to conclude that I'm against something or I'm for something, but I might. But I would suggest that what I want to talk about is the law of unintended consequences. Unintended consequences in altering or amending a sacred document, which in Tennessee is called the Tennessee Constitution. The very first section of the Declaration of Rights of the Tennessee Constitution provide that all power is inherent in the people, and all free governments are founded on their authority. And for the advancement of those ends, they have at all time, that is the people, an unalienable and indefeasible right to alter, reform, or abolish the government in such manner as they may think proper. There is no question that the process of amending the Constitution in Tennessee is a proper constitutional process. And I, frankly, applaud Senator Beavers for choosing the proper process to engage in this discussion of changing the way that the Attorney General gets his or her position. I have denounced and I have even officially opined that the process or an alternate process of creating a statute such as the Solicitor General statute that basically takes all of the authority of the Attorney General away from him and gives it to an elected Solicitor General is more likely than not unconstitutional. So I applaud Senator Beavers for choosing the right way of engaging in this discussion. I also applaud her for using the right way, if I recall correctly, in the way that if this passes the 107th General Assembly, in the way that it is published. So as to avoid any constitutional attacks between the 107th and the 108th General Assembly. Now, the process, most of you may know, of changing the Constitution involves a vote in one General Assembly by both houses that requires a majority vote. And then if that passes, then it must be published for 6 months prior to the election of the next General Assembly. And then the next General Assembly, which would be elected in November of 2012, sworn in 2013, it then would have to vote on that very same amendatory language, and it would have to get a two-thirds vote in each House. If all four of those votes pass, majority and two-thirds, then the question would come up before the voters in the gubernatorial election, which would be the second Tuesday in November of 2014. And then, of course, if that happened and the voters decided to change the way the Attorney General is selected or is elected, then that would come up, I think, in 2016 for the election of the Attorney General. That's the process. The process, as Ammon referred to, that we have now has been a process since the Constitution of 1870, right after the Civil War. We actually had no Attorney General during the Civil War, and then the Attorney General and Reporter was created, who, once he or she is selected by the Supreme Court, that person has an 8-year term, and if the Supreme Court decided, say, a couple of weeks after they made that appointment, that they didn't like their appointment, there's absolutely nothing that they can do about it. Because the Attorney General, under the Constitution we have today, has his or her 8-year term and is subject to being removed under the Constitution by the legislature, or being impeached and removed by the legislature. Also, obviously, the person could resign or die or not be reappointed at the next term. I can tell you from practical experience that an 8-year term is a long term as the Attorney General of the state of Tennessee. It is a term that, although it is a possibility that you might be appointed for the second term, it is not much of a probability that most men and women who occupy that office for 8 years will ask to reapply or will ask to be reappointed, because it's kind of like, I mean, it is a rich environment of issues and attacks and decisions and pressure every day. I truly enjoyed being Attorney General. I think it's the best job a lawyer could have, and that's the important part, because as Attorney General, you are not supposed to be a politician. You are supposed to be a professional. You are a lawyer. You are supposed to be accountable to whom, and I'll get to that in just a second. Let me tell you a little bit about me. I know that Ammon mentioned in his report, I read it, great report, thank you very much. My Democratic affiliation was because I had supposedly been mentioned as running for governor as a Democrat, and that's the only affiliation I had. Well, let me set the record straight. I didn't run for governor, either as a Republican, Democrat, Whig, or independent. It makes no difference. Let me tell you a little bit about my political background. After coming back from the JAG Corps in 1979, I practiced law in Somerville, Tennessee, my hometown. I did everything. I wrote wills. I had a small private practice. I practiced door law, whatever came through the door. I was also appointed by the court many times, the Circuit Court, the General Sessions Court, to represent indigent criminal defendants. I also was appointed by the court many times to be conservator or a guardian ad litem, or in some cases a special district attorney pro tem when the local district attorney was or had a conflict. I did that quite often. You do that in the country practice. Never did anyone ever say that I had a conflict of interest in representing a side, or that I was influenced by the very court that appointed me to one of these positions by representing the interest of a litigant within that court. But anyway, well, after private practice, I got the notion that I did want to get involved in politics. So I decided that I wanted to be District Attorney General of the 25th Judicial District, which was the 5-county district in West Tennessee in which I lived. The local district attorney resigned 8 months prior. Lamar Alexander, a person whom I've always respected for his good judgment in making selections, appointed me for that 8-month interim term to be the district attorney general in the 25th Judicial District. In that year, I ran, and as a matter of fact, I ran 2 times total. I ran in 82 and 1990 as an independent. I did not run in a partisan election and was elected as the district attorney for the 25th. 1990, vacancy opened on the Court of Criminal Appeals for the Western Section. Ned McWhorter, who also has a tremendous amount of integrity and selection ability, appointed me to the Court of Criminal Appeals. I then ran on the Retention Tennessee Plan, as been referred to later, two times, 1992 and 2000, in a statewide retention race, yes, no ballot. I was running against no. I was running against non-retention, and fortunately was elected on both occasions. Now, it has been said, now we're not here to talk about the Tennessee Plan, but it has been mentioned, I want to set the record straight on that. It has been mentioned that the Tennessee Plan is not an election process, is not an election process where a judge is not accountable. I would suggest that if you don't think there's accountability, then ask Justice Penny White back in August of 1996, who was soundly defeated by the voters for being retained in the office of the Supreme Court, if that's not an accountable system. As were three recently unelected or unretained justices in the Supreme Court of Iowa who were unretained, I would say that they felt like they're pretty accountable to the voters of Iowa. Anyway, that's the Tennessee Plan. We're here to talk about the Attorney General. In 1998, a vacancy occurred in the Attorney General's office when Knox Walker, the present Attorney General, decided not to ask to be reappointed when the term expired. He was filling the unexpired term of Charlie Burson, his predecessor. I put my name in the hat along with six or seven other lawyers around the state of Tennessee. The Supreme Court announced an open process. They had an application process that Woody kind of looked like a national security check document. It had about 35 pages or something. We went through an open process, and on December the 10th, the Supreme Court interviewed all of us. People could come. They could say good things about us. They could say bad things about us. And then ultimately, the Supreme Court decided that they would appoint me, and I took office on January the 8th, 1999. And then I served for about 8 years after that. Now, when I made my address to the Supreme Court in January of 1999, I made sure I made two points to them. The first point was that I am really appreciative of your selecting me as Attorney General. And quite frankly, I wouldn't have been selected as Attorney General if I hadn't had two Republican votes on the Supreme Court, both of whom were friends of mine, one of whom served with the Court of Criminal Appeals with me prior to that. But I told them that there are two things I want you to understand. Now, this was after I'd been sworn in, mind. Number one, I am appreciative. Thank you very much. Number two, I'm independent. And I'm going to represent my client, and that's just the end of it. And every one of them nodded affirmatively because they expected no less. They expected no less. As a practical matter, the Attorney General of the state of Tennessee is the head of the largest law firm in the state, or at least it was when I left, about 170 lawyers. The Attorney General is in charge of every piece of litigation that the state has, and 99% of the pieces of litigation the state of Tennessee is on the right side, meaning the defendant side, of the verses in the style of a lawsuit. There are only two divisions in the Attorney General's office that are plaintiff's divisions that go out and are proactive rather than reactive. And that is the antitrust division, which basically has become a feat in the Attorney General's office, and the consumer protection division that you hear a lot about. But 99% of the litigation in the Attorney General's office is the Attorney General literally defending the $30 million budget that the taxpayers of Tennessee own. He or she is in a reactive mode, not an active mode. Of the probably 10,000 active cases in the Attorney General's office. The Attorney General probably personally appears maybe in half a dozen, maybe at most a dozen, before the Tennessee Supreme Court. In my 8 years as Attorney General, I guess I appeared before the Supreme Court maybe five times. I appeared before the United States Supreme Court once. That's the one I really remember, by the way. But they don't appear very often. But regardless, whether the Attorney General or whether the Assistant Attorneys General or whether Deputy the Attorney General are representing their client in the state, it makes no difference whatsoever as to who appoints that person to be in that courtroom. Matter of fact, every lawyer in the state of Tennessee who is licensed to practice law is appointed by the Tennessee Supreme Court to have that law license. Every lawyer in the state of Tennessee, Linda Knight, was appointed by the Supreme Court to be a lawyer, to be in the courtroom, to be in the Circuit Court of Sumner County, for that matter. But every lawyer is expected to do his or her job to represent his or her client zealously, ethically, and within the bounds of propriety and within the bounds of the law. And the Supreme Court, the governor, the legislature, and the Constitution expects no less. I've used all my time. I'm sorry. Thank you. I wish I'd had more time to talk. Thank you.
Hammond?
Thank you, General Summers and Senator Beavers. Thought I had is that perhaps if all the men are women, although I don't think we've had any women serve as the AG yet in Tennessee, but if they were like General Summers, it probably wouldn't matter what appointment process we have. If they've got integrity, they'll do the right thing. But I'm a little bit more of a skeptic when it comes to human nature. And General Summers raised two interesting points, one being the proper process to amend the Constitution, and the other being unintended consequences. The Tennessee plan embodies both of those, both unintended consequences and the proper process or improper process to amend the Constitution. By that I mean the word elect, or the Supreme Court holding that the word elect means retention, referenda, has unintended consequences. And I think this process is one of them, although I'm about to make the argument that it wasn't so unintended. But to start off in broad strokes, to finally share with you my own personal opinion, I will tell you what I think is the best model going forward, is that either election or gubernatorial appointment is preferable to the current system. Now I want to outline why I think that way. Again, unintended consequences. Historically, the Attorney General in the state of Tennessee was more of a clerical position. The title for the Attorney General is Attorney General and Reporter, which basically means that the Attorney General cataloged all the Supreme Court opinions among other clerical duties that he historically had. Over time, the duties of the Attorney General have morphed more into executive-type functions. General Summers shared some of what those executive-type functions are. And then in addition to that, getting back to unintended consequences, or intended, rather, in a newsletter from the Chronicle, this was from, it's a newsletter of the Tennessee Supreme Court Historical Society from the fall of 2010. I want to quote from our current Attorney General, General Bob Cooper. And he was talking about, of course, the Tennessee plan was put into place in the early 70s. And Governor Dunn, who actually was a Republican governor, was the one who signed that into law. Shortly thereafter was repealed. And then in 1994, at least repealed with respect to the Supreme Court. And then in 1994 was put back into place so that, again, the Supreme Court would be elected by retention referenda. The reasons as to why that was done, let me quote, the Democratic leadership feared that Winfield Dunn, the first Republican governor in 50 years, would appoint a majority of Republican justices, and this is the point that's applicable to what we're doing today, who in turn would appoint a Republican as Attorney General, who at that time was a member of the powerful State Building Commission. This was not acceptable. So the General Assembly removed the Supreme Court from the modified Missouri plan during its 1974 session over Governor Dunn's veto. think that gives you a little bit of insight into the purpose and reason that we have the current structure that we have today. So talking about unintended consequences, the paper, as you note, doesn't really dig into particular or try to say a particular AG opinion is partisan as compared to another. And that's intentional. What I think the paper highlights is the fact that the real issue here is credibility over the long term. Credibility not only with the Attorney General's office, but credibility of the Supreme Court. Because again, the Tennessee plan and the Attorney General are inseparable. General Summers made reference to the fact that the Supreme Court and lower courts appoint individuals who are advocates. With respect to the lower courts, I think it's comparing apples to oranges. The Supreme Court, with respect to state law issues, is the court of last resort. So the question is, who's looking over the Supreme Court's shoulder if they screw something up, or if they're in collision with the Attorney General, or if something improper is going on? Now, there may be mechanisms to address that. In fact, in some of the footnotes in our paper, we address issues like standing and who can sue in those certain types of instances. But just to throw out a hypothetical, you know, if you were to superimpose Tennessee's system on the federal system, where the Supreme Court were to appoint, say, Alberto Gonzalez but I'm thinking around 9/11, Ashcroft, and everything that happened around 9/11, there was a unity in thought at that time, and a lot of folks on the left felt that civil liberties were sacrificed by the Attorney General and the actions that the Attorney General had taken. And of course, who ultimately is going to review those questions of civil liberties? Well, it's the United States Supreme Court. How do you think it will affect the credibility of the Supreme Court if the Supreme Court is the one that appoints the Attorney General when those types of issues come before the court? It's problematic. Or another way to put it is that the incentives are misaligned. That's why, or one of the reasons I have a problem with the current process. Now, you may stand back and say, well, we really haven't had issues like that in Tennessee. And I think there are a number of reasons as to why that's the case. One is because historically the Attorney General was really more clerical in nature, you know, acted more as a clerk. Another, though, is that anybody that knows Tennessee politics knows that prior to 1971, it was a one-party state. Talk to Macklin Davis if you have any doubt about that. And as a one-party state, a lot of coordination, I'm sure, went on. I'm sure that they had fierce differences of opinion, but in those days, it really was not between Republicans and Democrats. It was a question of incumbent Democrats and newcomers that were Democrats. Those dynamics have changed significantly, and only recently have the Republicans taken control of both houses, of the Senate and the House. I think going forward, we are going to have, or potentially could have, significant issues because things that may not have been brought to light previously are going to be brought to light in the future because you are, in fact, going to have a true public dialogue between the two parties. It's why a two-party system is preferable to a single-party system. It's because you actually get the issues out into the open. And so, again, I think the incentives for the current system are misaligned. Another distinction that I think needs to be clearly made, in the debate over the Tennessee plan, the two virtues that you want your judges to have are independence and accountability. But those two virtues conflict. But there are ways, and it's been debated at length as to how to balance those. I think to a lesser extent, at least with respect to independence, the same two virtues apply for the Attorney General. You want your Attorney General to be independent in thought, but you also want your Attorney General to be accountable. Well, the problem with the current structure is that there's a double layer of insulation such that the Attorney General really is virtually accountable to no one because of issues of standing. And the fact that the Attorney General's position has morphed into a position of executive-like functions, that's a problem. Because the Attorney General, without any, you know, degree of oversight or accountability, could run amok. Now, it hasn't happened because we've had good men like General Summers serving in that position. But again, human nature being what it is, the incentives need to be realigned so that there are proper checks and balances to keep that in check going forward. But I guess those would be the main points that I have. With that, Justin, I think we do.
All right.
Move on.
Senator Beavers, did you, you're welcome to respond.
From here.
Wherever you like.
I'll just say in response to some of the things that have been pointed out, and there may be some disagreement in this room about the Tennessee plan. I voted against the bill that we passed a couple of years ago renewing that, and it made a few changes in it. But the thing it didn't change was the Constitution. The Constitution still says that the Supreme Court judges shall be elected by the people. And so, you know, to refer back to that and the whole process, you know, of the Attorney General, you know, it's all messed up. We need to change the Constitution if we're going to have the Tennessee plan. That needs to be set out in the Constitution. General Summers pointed out that the Attorney General was in charge of all of the litigation. That was given to him by statute. That came much later, after the Constitution was written. I think it's been pointed out today that in the beginning he was simply the reporter for the Supreme Court. And he used, General Summers used the analysis of him being appointed guardian ad litem in a court. The difference there is he is appointed by an elected judge who answers to the people. The Attorney General, in my opinion, is not appointed by elected judges. He is appointed by appointed judges. That makes him twice removed from the people, so he's not answering to the people. We've had some good attorney generals. I don't disagree with that. Some attorney generals with some integrity. But we need to change the process. You know, whether it's by election, whether or not we take some of those duties that were given to the attorney general by statute and put those in a solicitor general, you know, I'm open on the discussion. We have another bill in committee here in another week or so that would give some of the duties to the Solicitor General and have the Solicitor General appointed by the General Assembly. So I'm open-minded when it comes to elections, appointments, but I think that we need to answer to the people of the state of Tennessee. The Attorney General needs to be answerable to the people of Tennessee, whether it's by appointment by an elected governor or appointment by an elected General Assembly or the popular election.
Thank you. Let me share with you a Tennessee history lesson. When you get through with this meeting, go all the way around to that big conference room on the opposite end of this floor, and you'll see a room called the Overton Room. And in that room are former leaders in this law firm, and one of those leaders' portraits is that of a former partner and former Attorney General, William Leach from Columbia, Tennessee. And Bill Leach served as the 20th Attorney General in the state of Tennessee, and as Ammon pointed out, that was during the regime of the Democrats, when Democrats were elected to everything in Tennessee. And I want to share with you comments made by my favorite former governor, Lamar Alexander, that man who has a great ability to select good district attorneys general, and now Senator Alexander, when he was relating to a personal incident in his life, in his political life and in his personal life, that occurred on January the 17th, 1979. Now let me give a little bit of background. The current governor was Ray Blanton, a Democrat, truly a yellow dog Democrat. And Ray Blanton's campaign and his political administration had been plagued with controversy ever since the beginning. And he didn't run for re-election, and one of the reasons Ray Blanton didn't run for re-election is because he had been hounded with investigations of corruption. Joe Brown, former attorney, former U.S. attorney, and in the Attorney General's office, I believe, at that time, knows exactly what I'm talking about. Ray Blanton had been accused of selling clemency for cash. And for those of us who can remember back during those times, we remember the times well when people in the Blanton administration actually were arrested. For example, his legal counsel was arrested. Lamar Alexander got elected in November of 1978. He was going to be sworn in as governor in January of 1979. Rumors had circulated among all the leaders in the legislature and in all the leaders in the legislature primarily and the executive branch that he was going to commute and pardon 52 criminals, including Roger Humphreys. Remember Roger Humphreys, who shot and killed his wife and her former lover, and I believe he shot him 18 times with a 2-bullet Derringer. Ray Blanton was going to pardon these people. So the Speaker of the House, Democrat Ned McWhorter, the Speaker of the Senate, Democrat John Wilder, went to ostensibly the Democrat Attorney General Bill Leach and said, "What must we do?" Democrat Bill Leach called up Lamar Alexander, the new Republican governor, and said, "I've researched it. I feel like I'm comfortable on constitutional grounds, and we need you to be sworn in 3 days earlier to get Ray Blanton out of office." Republican Senator Lamar Alexander, in the Congressional Record, on March the 26th, 2007, he's quoted as saying, "Mr. Alexander, Madam President, my late friend Alex Haley, the author of Roots, lived his life by 6 words: find the good and praise it. I have a personal interest in the example I offer. Nearly 30 years ago, on January the 17th, I was sworn into office 3 days early as governor of Tennessee in order to prevent the incoming governor from issuing 52 pardons and commutations to prisoners the FBI believed had paid cash for their release. The U.S. Attorney for the Middle District of Tennessee, Hal Hardin, a Democrat, and the Attorney General, William Leach, another Democrat, arranged for an unprecedented early swearing in." Then later, now Supreme Court and Republican Justice Bill Koch made the statement in a white paper that he drafted in March of 2007, and he said, and I quote, "The principal figures in this political drama agree that the events of January the 17th, 1979 would not have been unfolded the way they did had it not been for Hal Hardin and Bill Leach. These lawyers placed the rule of law and governmental integrity ahead of political expediency and personal reputation." I dare say that if Bill Leach ever thought he was going to run for governor as a Democrat, then all of his ambitions were extinguished on January the 17th, 1979. But I also dare say, having been in that office and been the 25th Attorney General after Bill Leach, that he didn't care. He didn't care one iota whether or not it was going to ruin his political ambitions, because he was representing the Constitution. He was representing the rule of law. I can also tell you that not only Bill Leach, but none of his 5 successors ever had a meeting, a conference, a discussion with the Tennessee Supreme Court about how they're going to run their offices. That just doesn't happen, folks. It just doesn't happen. We talk about accountability. If you elect the Attorney General of the state of Tennessee, to whom are they going to be accountable? You know, lawyers deal with the transference of people's problems. Lawyers deal with people's problems or their potential problems. You hire a lawyer to tell you what you need to hear, not what you want to hear or what the majority thinks that you should hear. You hire a lawyer to tell you what the law is, not what the law ought to be, but what the law is. Are you going to be, if you're elected, are you going to be accountable to your campaign contributors, to your political party, to political special interest groups? You know, the Attorney General is pretty accountable now. I remember for 8 different times when I was Attorney General, I had to trek up over there to the legislature and present my budget to 3 different committees. And at any one given time, as Senator Beavers wells know, because I presented my budget to the Senate Judiciary Committee that she sat on for, I know, at least that long. I also presented my budget to the House Finance Ways and Means Committee and the Senate Finance Ways Committee. I can assure you that if those 3 bodies, those 3 committees, thought that I wasn't being accountable or that the Attorney General's office wasn't being accountable, then they would make sure that we knew by the end of that session that accountability means who has the purse strings. I can assure you of that. Is not the power of impeachment and removal from office accountability? Under our Constitution, if the Attorney General or a District Attorney General does something that doesn't even have to be a high crime or a misdemeanor, if the legislature decides that he or she, an attorney for the state, is not performing his or her duties consistent with the Constitution or with the rule of law, then they have 2 methods to remove them from office. One is through impeachment, and one is through removal under Article 5 of the Constitution. Now, it's been said by Ammon, for example, that Supreme Court's got too much influence over the Attorney General. I don't understand. 99% of the cases that the Attorney General or his office, I mean, the Attorney General actually doesn't present the case, but his office presents to the Supreme Court are cases in which the Attorney General's side, that is the state of Tennessee, is a defendant. They are reactionary. We have to react to a lawsuit that's been filed. What motivation would the Supreme Court have to try to influence a lawyer for one of the sides when they're the ones who have the votes? They don't need to influence anybody. I mean, why do they want to influence a litigant? They could just vote against him. I don't understand that concept. Let me also tell you another unintended consequence. 90% of the people in Tennessee, if you go down on the street, 90% of the people in Tennessee thinks that the Attorney General is the top cop and chief law enforcement and chief policeman in the state. I'd say that probably 50% of the legislature does. And I'd say that 40%, at least 40% of the lawyers think that too. I mean, everybody thinks that. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've been into some function or meeting and say, we'll meet Paul Summers, he's the Attorney General of Tennessee. And it's Paul, it's nice to meet. And I know what's going through their mind. They think, well, he can put me in shape. That's what they all think. Well, let me tell you, the most powerful politician is not the Attorney General. The most powerful politician who should be and is accountable is the District Attorney General. And I can guarantee you, if you start electing the Attorney General of the state of Tennessee, who only has limited prosecution authority, and only limited in the sense that he can only independently prosecute judges and district attorneys if they're not doing their job, but if you give the Attorney General the power to be elected to get his or her job, then bill number one, Senate bill, House bill number one, after they get elected, and you want my words, will also be a piece of legislation that gives the Attorney General statewide prosecutorial authority with a statewide grand jury. And the question then is, do you want to have the prosecutorial decisions? And when you're a prosecutor, you have unbridled power and you are accountable to no one. Do you want your prosecutor to make prosecutorial decisions about a case in Sumner County, or a case in Fayette County, or a case in Hamilton County, do you want the prosecutor making those prosecutorial decisions from Hamilton County, Sumner County, or Fayette County, or do you want him or her to be making those from Nashville? That is what I'm talking about. Understand what you're doing, people, if you vote for this. I'm not saying it's bad, I'm not saying it's good, but that's what you can expect. And remember, Paul Summers on March 3rd, 2000,
Well, I'm going to open up for questions.
Oh. Okay.
That's fine. We've got a few minutes for questions from the audience. So if you have a question, let's take one. Mr. Woodruff.
Thank you very much. I want to thank all three panelists for being here and for sharing your insights and your knowledge on these issues. They're fascinating. And I was making questions, writing questions down as y'all were going through. Many of them have already been addressed, particularly the last one I was going to start with. So the multi-part question. Hammond, doesn't your research stop short in a couple of crucial ways?
I suppose you're going to tell me how it stopped. <Okay.
laughs> It stops short in two crucial ways, and those crucial ways are as follows. You look at what you claim to be partisan party affiliation, and then assume without any data that this mere partisan affiliation, which anecdotally General Summers says you got wrong on him, leads to behaviors or consequences of decision making that would have been different had the party affiliation been different. But you have no data on that point because you admittedly didn't look for that.
Sure.
So, and this is the second way that your research stops short, is that it doesn't take into account Paul's last point, which is that not all states' attorneys general are created equal. In some states, the state attorney general does have statewide prosecutorial power, prosecutorial jurisdiction. In other states, they do not. In some states, states' attorneys general have more robust civil plaintiff sorts of jurisdiction, and Tennessee does not. So shouldn't your research have had yet another column when you compare the analysis of the attorney general structure to actually look at the powers involved? And then doesn't that lead into the final point, which is that in those states where attorneys general are elected statewide, you have an automatic political rival with the chief executive and with any other cabinet member that may also be elected statewide? And I offer two examples, and my question is going to be, how do you explain these examples away if election is more preferable, non-political thing? In Alabama, just last year,
thank you so much,
governor and the elected attorney general had lobbyheads over gambling investigations in an extremely contentious political brawl. And about 10 years ago in Mississippi, the elected attorney general and the elected commissioner of insurance were involved in a political brawl over insurance rates and enforcing insurers to cover claims associated with Hurricane Katrina. So in order to really appreciate your research, shouldn't your research A, go further? Doesn't it stop short in two particular ways? And then how do you reconcile these examples in neighboring states where when you have partisan statewide elections, it certainly hasn't resulted in a diminution of conflict between two rival spheres of political influence?
As your lawyer, I advise you not to answer that question.
Well, first of all, that's a long question. Woody, I may have to ask you again what your question was. But in the paper, we made it clear, and I'll just quote, "Political affiliation is an imprecise lens to determine what priorities are most important to an acting attorney general, as political parties encompass a wide variety of views and beliefs, and it can be misleading to prejudge an individual's stance on any particular issue solely from his party affiliation." Hopefully that answers your first question. That's right. I think this research really was a look at the system itself, not necessarily as I stated earlier, what the individual opinions of the Attorney General are and which ones may or may not be partisan or not partisan. The second question of, keep in mind that my stance is that either direct election or a federal model would be preferable to the current system. I think if you plug your hypothetical into a federal model, it can change, particularly the Attorney General, in effect, becomes a member of the governor's cabinet. If he serves at the pleasure of the governor, they're no longer adversaries. The governor can get rid of him like that. So I don't think that you're going to find any system that has all the answers. I think every system, at least so far in my research, there are problems with each model. I just think that the Tennessee model, the Supreme Court appointment method, is misguided in the sense that there absolutely is no accountability. And the hypothetical I throw out there is the healthcare law. 26 states now, a majority of the states in the United States, have sued. Court in Florida has said that, yeah, it is unconstitutional. Now, that still has to flow up through the courts. Yet, even early in the process, before the bill was even passed, and you had all these kickbacks, and clearly, try to find the right adjective to describe it, or maybe I'll leave it to you, the kickbacks that upset the American people such, and in particular Tennesseans who were getting the raw end of the deal, and it was affecting their pocketbooks, what could the average Tennessean do in that scenario? And for that matter, what could the lieutenant governor, or what could anyone else do to force the attorney general to say, hey, look, we don't really care what your politics are, Tennessee, most of us say, we don't like this bill. We want you to do something about it. Our hands were tied. But I agree with you, and as soon as I can reduce my billable hour requirement, I might actually do a little bit more research with it. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, but I would like to hear Paul's comment about not all attorneys general being created equal, and shouldn't want to take into account when we consider the structure by which attorneys general are selected.
That's right. I'd say that the supermajority of attorneys general who are elected by partisan or popular vote also have prosecutorial authority. And that dovetails with what I'm talking about, the man on the street, the woman on the street. They think that their top cop that they elect ought to have prosecutorial authority. And that kind of dovetails with exactly what I'm talking about. There's no, probably Tennessee and Maine are the most unique states. Of the other, say, seven or eight states and territories, I do know how to count to 50. There's actually 55 when you count states and territories. So. They usually are appointed by the governor, and some of them are ratified by the legislature, or they are some of them are Maine is elected totally by the legislature. But the point is that one of the common threads of everyone that's elected is that he or she has the power to put you in jail, and that's a big deal. That's as close to being accountable to the people as you can get. That's the way most people think. Let me also say one more thing. We have a lot of talk about the influence of the courts on the litigants. That's just not reality. That's not reality at all. I mean, I can never, I can't imagine. First of all, I can't imagine a topic that the Supreme Court would be so interested in that I'm representing the state on that they'd want to come talk to me about it. But even if there was one, I can't imagine that happening. That just doesn't happen. Because we live in a world of lawyers representing clients, and it doesn't make any difference how you get your job as a lawyer representing your client. You uphold an oath to do the best you can for the client, no matter what the judge thinks about you. But I want to suggest that, you know, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. And as Woody said earlier, the system truly, ladies and gentlemen, is not broken. The system has truly worked well since 1870. At least during the 1900s, the system that we have that the Attorney General operates in has been basically the same. The system has worked flawlessly, and if you talk to the other attorneys general around the United States, every one of them says, you know, my election is really not in jeopardy. I don't have to worry about an election. But let me tell you what, you folks in Tennessee have got it right. And I say, why? They say, well, one thing, when I get elected, I have to open up two offices. Number one, I open up my Attorney General's office, and number two, I opened up my campaign to reelect Woody Woodruff, Attorney General of Alabama office. The second thing that happens, and I'm so glad you brought it up, the second thing that happens is when you have an elected Attorney General or an appointed Attorney General for less than 8 years, no state has the continuity in the personnel in the Attorney General's office like Tennessee. When I took my oath of office in 1999, there were 41 people in the Attorney General's office, 41 lawyers in the Attorney General's office in Tennessee who had been in the office more than 20 years. And I asked the Chief Deputy, Lucy Haynes, to give me some figures, and now the figure is over 41. And those same 41 people that were there when I went into office are still there. Let me tell you, Linda, you know how this is. There is nothing worse than having a 10-year ongoing lawsuit when you're representing your client over about $50 million and having to change lawyers in midstream. And that's what happens when you elect an attorney general. Because when you elect an attorney general, the first thing that she or he is going to do is going to wipe out their senior staff, is going to wipe out their experience so they can put their own people in there, and that doesn't do anything except serve a disservice to the state of Tennessee and to the $30 billion budget that they're trying to protect. That is another unintended consequence.
Sure. Any other question? You're welcome to respond if you
would. Okay. A few things. Well, the governor's elected, and he replaces his cabinet. I guess that's a huge disservice to the state of Tennessee as well. But with respect to the Supreme Court not having any influence, I disagree with that fundamentally. And let me throw out the example of the Tennessee plan, and particularly some of the controversy that surrounded this recent fundraising group that came about to raise money from large law firms who argue before the Supreme Court. I'm sure some of you followed that. But with respect to the Tennessee plan, the Supreme Court actively lobbied the legislature to keep it as currently constituted, and made a very public statement, a united front, with all of the appellate judges in the state to say, we think it's right, we think it should stay the way it is, don't mess with it. What message does that send to litigants that appear before the court? Just food for thought. So the Supreme Court can and does influence the activities of litigants before it. I think I'll stop with that, Justin.
Well, we've actually reached the end of our appointed time. So first, I'd like to thank Waller Lansden again for hosting this event. And I'd like to thank
our three speakers for providing what I think everyone would agree was an extremely thoughtful, in-depth, and engaging discussion. This sort of event, this sort of debate and discussion is what the Federalist Society is all about. If you've been to these events before, you knew that. If this is your first time, now you know it. If you're interested in joining the Society, there's membership brochures on the outside. And by all means, please join our email list, and we'll keep you posted about future events. Thank you so much.
All right. I didn't go best now.